You're listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Genesis, Secrets of Creation. Now, this is the last lecture, Lecture 11 in the book. However, it is, in fact, I believe, the first lecture given before the cycle occurred. So that last lecture was, in fact, the end of the cycle. This was the first lecture given on the 16th of August, 1910, entitled The Portal of Initiation, of course, which is one of Rudolf Steiner's first mystery drama. So, we are about to begin an important series of lectures, and I am sure it is permissible to tell you beforehand that we could not have undertaken them without all the work already achieved in the anthroposophical field. Another thing is that the momentous ideas to which we shall be devoting ourselves over the coming days need, in a certain respect, the kind of mood we were able to acquire from seeing the two dramas which have just been performed. These performances were meant to give our hearts the kind of feeling mood necessary for us to bring the right warmth and intensity into what comes toward us in the anthroposophical realm. There have been many occasions when I have reminded you that abstract thoughts, even the ideas belonging to our field, acquire their full effect on us only if they are experienced with warm inner feelings. Without these, we would not be sensitive enough to realize that with the help of anthroposophical ideas we are approaching areas of existence for which we should not only have intellectual curiosity, but also a mood of heart which we can, in the fullest sense, call a holy mood. It is probably a long time since I had the kind of feelings in my heart, such as I have now, in anticipation of lectures, of which we may be justified in saying that they venture to bring human thoughts a little way toward the primordial word, which for millennia has taken hold of human hearts and occupied human minds, and which raises human beings in heart and mind to the highest, most sublime heights to which they can aspire, to the majesty of our own origins. After the past 2 days, which have prepared us for these lectures, may I be permitted, before they begin, to touch on an intimate aspect of our anthroposophical work. At the start of last year's talks, I was already able to point out the symbolic importance these particular Munich performances have for our anthroposophical life. I stressed the way we have been carried for years by what we could call, in a real anthroposophical sense, the patience of waiting until the forces required for the task have matured. Let me remind you once again that title The Children of Lucifer, which we were fortunate enough to be able to perform last year, and to our joy, repeat this year, had to be patiently awaited for 7 years. This play had to be preceded by 7 years of work in the field of anthroposophy. I had the opportunity to remind you last year that at the conclusion of the founding of our German section in Berlin, I gave a lecture in conjunction with this play titled The Children of Lucifer, and that in those days the idea of being able to present this play on the stage was still an ideal. After 7 years of anthroposophical work, this has now happened, and we may say that the performance last year signified a kind of milestone in our anthroposophical activities. We were able to present our dear friends with an artistic development of anthroposophical feeling and thinking. It is in moments such as these, when we feel ourselves surrounded and filled with anthroposophical life, that we feel we have really found our anthroposophical milieu. The author of title The Children of Lucifer, whom we had the pleasure of seeing here last year at the performance, and the lectures, and whose presence we are enjoying again this year, has, in his epoch-making work titled The Great Initiates, presented the spiritual life of today with a kind of web of ideas, the effect of which on the hearts and minds of the people of the present day only the future will set in the right light. Footnote, and this book is written by Edward Charest from France. End of reader's aside. You would often be surprised if you were to look at the estimation people have today of the spiritual powers and spiritual achievements of one past age or another, and compare it with the way the people of those times actually saw themselves. We very easily confuse the way we ourselves think of Goethe, Shakespeare, or Dante with the kind of insight their contemporaries had for perceiving the spiritual forces individuals such as these men embodied in the developing spirit of humankind. Especially as anthroposophists, we must make ourselves aware of the fact that in our own time, people can appreciate least of all the significant and strengthening effect the spiritual endeavors of their contemporaries have on human souls. If you bear in mind how differently things will be judged in the future than they are today, you may perhaps say that the time will come when, titled The Great Initiates, will be regarded, both for its content and its depth, as a work of colossal significance. For already today, soul echoes are being heard throughout the widest field of culture, precisely because these ideas have found entry into the hearts of our contemporaries. And indeed, these echoes are surely important for our contemporaries. To innumerable people, they have meant support in life, consolation and hope in the hardest moments of their existence. Only if we can really rejoice over the intellectual and spiritual feats of the present day do we have the right to say that we possess anthroposophical sensitivity and an anthroposophical mood on a somewhat grander scale. The characters who appear entitled The Children of Lucifer have also received their shape and form from out of the same soul depths whence came the ideas entitled The Great Initiates. And these characters present our inner eye, EYE, with a view of an eminent period in the evolution of humankind, when what had grown old and what was newly bursting into life encounter one another. Anthroposophists should understand the way two elements come together, human life, work and action on the physical plane, as presented by the characters we see entitled The Children of Lucifer, and shedding its light into this work and action, what we call illumination from higher worlds. By putting a drama on the stage, showing not only that human striving and human capacities are rooted in our hearts and heads, but also that inspiration from the initiation centers of the temple as invisible powers inspire and spiritualize our hearts. By showing this interweaving of supersensible worlds with our sense world, we have been able to set up a milestone in our anthroposophical movement. It should be said again this year, at the start of our lectures, that the essential part of such an undertaking are the hearts of those who have the insight to understand such a work. A great mistake in our times is to think that once a work has been created, it is bound to have an effect as such. It does not depend solely on the great works of Raphael or Michelangelo being in the world. It depends on the existence in this world of human beings in whose hearts and souls the magic of these works can be brought to life. Raphael and Michelangelo did not create their works for themselves alone. They did them in response to those of their contemporaries who were filled with the culture of the times and were capable of receiving what they had committed to the canvas. Our present culture is chaotic. It has no integrity of feeling. However great the masterpieces might be that affect our culture, they will not touch our hearts. It must be a singular characteristic of our anthroposophical movement that we are a circle of friends who share the same feelings, are inspired by the same thoughts, and are capable of the same enthusiasm. A drama takes place on the stage and in the hearts of the spectators. A drama takes place, the forces of which belong to time what the hearts of the audience felt, what took root in every heart, is a seed for the life of the future. Let us feel this, my dear friends. Let us make sure we do not only feel a sense of satisfaction, for that might be a bit shabby, but let us be aware of the responsibility we are taking on board, the kind of responsibility that tells us to set an example for what has to happen, what has to become possible, so that the culture of the times becomes impregnated with an awareness of the human being here on the physical plane, being a mediator between physical deeds and physical development on the one hand, and the forces from the supersensible world, which can enter into these realms of the physical plane only through human beings. In a sense, we shall only become a spiritual family if we turn toward the general primordial principle of the Father, which lives in our hearts, and which I have just been trying to characterize. If we do take up with our hearts, with our whole mood of soul, what we experience, feeling ourselves as members of our anthroposophical family, then we shall really appreciate with the warmest inner satisfaction our good fortune in being able to have the author of titled The Children of Lucifer with us for the two performances and the days to follow. What I am saying is that this will really enable us to feel that the living anthroposophical forces of the present day are alive in the circle from which such works as we have experienced in the last couple of days have come. My dear friends, last year I already took up the pleasant duty of drawing your attention to the very place of work in which we have been able to achieve such a milestone of our anthroposophical activities. And I would like to emphasize that you must not understand duty in its ordinary everyday meaning. It was a duty which was a labor of love, and I stress the word love. It was and is a labor of love to be able to say again at this moment in time that for the successful realization of these our anthroposophical events, our friends worked not only eagerly, but with all their strength and all their devotion. When you see performances like these, you may not always realize how long it takes until what can finally be presented in a few hours becomes fit to perform. And the manner in which our dear friends cooperated to bring the production about could well be taken as a model of anthroposophical work, possibly even of human cooperation altogether. Particularly when we consider that it would go against a proper anthroposophical feeling to give orders in any way in this sort of work. It is only possible to go ahead if the individuals are wholeheartedly involved in quite a different way than could happen in a similar artistic field outside. Moreover, this wholehearted involvement existed not only in the few short weeks at our disposal for preparing the performances, for this loving, voluntary cooperation has gone on for years. On this occasion, people have come together from far and wide, and anthroposophists do not only want to get to know one another through exchanging just a few words, but want to find out about everyone else's deepest ideals. Thus, it is right to draw your attention in a few words to the way people have been working here for years, so as to bring together at the right moment what was required to set going the kind of achievement which we have just been able to present. Even if it were not called for by outer circumstances alone, my heart would urge me to take this opportunity to draw your attention to the devoted work of our friends who have made it possible for us to have these experiences. For, believe me, without this devoted work, it would not have been possible. As I said, I want to begin these lectures with a kind of intimate discussion of something that can be close to our hearts. Let us remember, first and foremost, the years of dedicated work of the two ladies who have been working so purposefully and with such sensitivity for our anthroposophical intentions. For many years now, Fräulein Stinde and Countess Kalkreuth have devoted all their forces to the anthroposophical work going on here. And I am the best judge of the fact that the event we were able to lay on to our satisfaction would not have been possible without their dedicated, purposeful help that has been in such harmony with our anthroposophical impulses. Therefore, you will find it all the more comprehensible that I am availing myself of this opportunity to say these few words to our two colleagues here in Munich with a very grateful heart. In addition to this, there were the people who were keeping everything going with such devotion during the weeks while our activities were taking place. Yesterday we endeavored, by way of an artistic picture, to set before you the path to the heights on which the human being can experience what should be inherent in anthroposophical development, and what, so to speak, a spiritual investigator ought to experience. The opportunity may present itself in connection with various things that will be said during these lectures to refer to one thing or another that was presented to you yesterday. We endeavored to show the life of someone aspiring toward spiritual knowledge, to show how he grows out of the physical plane, how even here on the physical plane, everything that happens around him, and which might seem really mundane to another person, is of importance to him. The soul of the spiritual seeker has to grow out of the soil of the events of the physical plane. We then endeavored to show what the soul has to experience within itself when everything going on around us in the way of human destiny, human suffering and joy, human striving and illusion pours into it. How the soul can be crushed and shattered, and yet the power of wisdom can work its way through this destruction, until in the moment when the human being believes that he has at last become a stranger to the sense world, he is approached by the really big illusions. With the words, quote, "the world is Maya or illusion," close quote, or quote, "through knowledge we find our way to wisdom," close quote, we say a lot, and yet very little. What these words are actually saying has to be experienced by each individual in his own way. Therefore, what applies in general could only be shown with a genuine soul force pulsating through it, if it were to be shown in the form of an individual's own experience. What has to be shown is not how everyone approaches the region of initiation, but the way the absolutely individual character of Johannes Thomasius, out of his own particular circumstances, is able to approach the gates of knowledge. It would be totally wrong if someone were to believe that he could consider the occurrence shown in the meditation room of Maria ascending out of her body into Devakan as a general one. It is an absolutely real, spiritually real happening, but one that should show the impulse to ascend to the spiritual world in the particular way a personality such as that of Johannes Thomasius demonstrates. I want to draw your special attention to the moment when we are shown that at the very instant when his soul has basically acquired the force to see through ordinary illusion, it is exposed to the possibility of the really big illusions. Imagine Johannes Thomasius not being in a position to realize, not even just sensing it with his inner eye, EYE, let alone in any way consciously, that in the character left behind in the meditation room and hurling a curse at the Hierophant, the very individuality he is meant to follow is no longer present. Imagine the Hierophant, or even Johannes Thomasius, becoming agitated by this, even for a moment. It would then have become impossible for an incalculable span of time that Johannes Thomasius could continue on the path of knowledge. The whole thing would have been over at that moment, and not only for Johannes Thomasius, but also for the Hierophant, who would then not have been capable of developing in Johannes Thomasius the strong forces which can lead him beyond this obstacle. The Hierophant would have had to resign from his office, and tremendously long spans of time would have been lost to Johannes Damasius in his progress. If you try to visualize the scenes that immediately precede this moment, and the feelings going on in the soul of Johannes Damasius, the particular type of pain, the particular kind of experience, then you may perhaps come to the conclusion that even if he may not be aware of it himself, the power of wisdom has become so strong in him that he can surmount this tremendous jolt. All these experiences taking place without anything visibly hovering before the inner eye of the soul have to happen first, so that they can be adequately followed up by what comes next, namely, the spiritual world showing the soul something which, even if it is initially in picture form, is nevertheless objective. This happens in the following scenes. First of all, his whole person is thoroughly shaken by pain, by the violent emotion coming from his having withstood the possibility of a great illusion. All this works itself into a tremendous tension in the soul, which, if we can describe it this way, reverses the gaze, so that what was only subjective before can now appear to the soul with the force of objectivity. What we see in the following scenes, and which I have attempted to describe in a spiritually realistic way, presents what the person developing gradually into higher worlds feels to be the outer mirror image of the feelings he experienced first of all in his soul. And what is true, without his yet knowing fully how much of it is true. The human being is, first of all, led upward, so that he can see how time, in which we dwell as sensory beings, is, with regard to its causes and effects, bordered on all sides by other domains. You see, not only the small section of it presented by the sense world, but you come to understand that what appears before us in the sense world is only the outer expression of spirit. Therefore, with his spiritual eye, EYE, Johannes Damasius sees the man, whom he has first met on the physical plane, Capasius, not as he is now, but as he was decades ago as a young man. And he sees the other one, Strader, not in the form he has at present, but he has a premonition of what he will be like if he continues to develop in the way he is doing up to the present. We understand this moment only when we can stretch it beyond the present, both into the past and into the future. Then we approach the realm with which everything happening in the present is connected as with spiritual threads. Then the spiritual world comes to meet us, the spiritual world with which the human being always has a relationship, even if he is not capable of grasping it with his ordinary physical intellect and ordinary sensuousness. Believe me, it is no mere image or symbol, but a realistic description in the scene in which the young Capasius describes his ideals with the kind of heartiness which would be justified in the sense world. Ideals which, where the spiritual world is concerned, have the peculiarity that, after all, they have their roots in the external world perceived by the senses. It is absolutely realistic when we are shown that what he and Strader say stirs up the elements and unleashes lightning and thunder. The human being is not an isolated being. What a human being expresses in words, activates in thoughts, experiences in feelings, is connected with the whole cosmos, and every word, every feeling, and every thought continues. Without a human being knowing it, his mistakes, his untrue feelings, work destructively in the elemental realm of our existence. And what anyone going along this path of knowledge needs to be sure to learn from these preliminary experiences in the spiritual world is a profound sense of responsibility which says, quote, what you do as a human being is not confined to the isolated spot where your lips move, where you think, and where your heart beats. It is part of all the world. If it is productive, then it is productive for the whole world. If it is a destructive error, it is a destructive force in the whole world. Close quote. Everything we experience in this way on our ascent works further in our soul. If it works in the right way, it bears us upward into higher regions of spiritual life, as I have endeavored to describe in the devachanic realm into which the soul of Maria, along with her companions, has gone on ahead of Johannes Thomasius. Take it as a spiritual reality, and not as an abstract thought, when I tell you that these three helpers, Philia, Astrid, and Luna, are the forces which, in abstracto, when we are speaking from the point of view of the physical plane, we call the sentient soul, the intellectual soul, and the consciousness soul. But do not succumb to the illusion that anything is achieved if you try in an artistically conceived production to symbolize the characters by means of abstract concepts. That is not what is intended. They are meant to be real characters, active forces. You will not find notice boards in Devakan with sentient soul, intellectual soul, and consciousness soul written on them, but real beings, as real for the spirit world as any human being of flesh and blood can be for the physical plane. A human being ought to be aware of the fact that he robs things of their content if he tries to define everything in abstract symbolism. In the world in which Johannes Thomasius has hitherto been active, he has only experienced what you could call the spiritual world spread out before his soul in picture form. Whether he himself, as a subjective being, is the author of this world, or whether it is founded in truth, he has not been capable of deciding up to now. How much of this world is illusion, and how much is reality, he has to decide for the first time now that he has come into that exalted region in which he meets with the soul of Maria. Try imagining that one night after you have gone to sleep, you are suddenly transported into quite a different world, and you cannot find in this other world one single point of reference that links up with your previous experiences. Then you would not be the same person, the same being. You must have the chance of taking something over into the other world and seeing it again there in order to guarantee truth. You can only do this in the case of the spiritual world if you have already acquired a firm foothold that assures you of the truth. In this dramatic presentation, this is intended to be provided for in that, on the physical plane, Johannes Thomasius is connected with Maria's being, not only through his emotions and passions, but in the depths of his heart, so that a spiritual connection already exists on the physical plane. This is the only way in which this friendship could be the kind of focal point in the spiritual world that confirms the truth of everything else within it. The certainty of truth radiates out over everything else in the spiritual world because Johannes Thomasius finds a foothold which he has discovered in the physical world in a different way than through the mere illusions of sensuousness or intellect. This links the two worlds together for him and makes him sufficiently mature to be able to spread his memory in reality over past lives, and in doing so to grow in soul beyond the sense world as we know it. This is why, at this point, something occurs which, if we may put it this way, embraces a certain mystery of the spiritual world. Theodora, who on the physical plane sees into the future and is able to foresee the momentous event beginning to occur, the reappearance of the Christ, is capable on the spiritual plane of calling up a vision of the significance of past events. If we are going to give a realistic portrayal, we have to present it in the spiritual world as it really happens. For the beings dwelling in Devakan, the past, with the significance its forces have for them, is enhanced because in that region the forces that are becoming active there are the opposite of the forces we perceive here on the physical plane as the forces of prophecy. It is a realistic picture when Theodora, who on the physical plane can prophesy the future, is on the spiritual plane the conscience and memory awakener for what has happened in the past, and thus brings about the moment through which Johannes Damasius looks back into his own past, to when he was already connected with the individuality of Maria. This prepares him in his further life to go through everything that will lead him to a conscious recognition of the spiritual world. And you will see how, on the one hand, the soul changes into something quite different when subjected to the experiences of spiritual worlds, how everything appears in a new light. You will see how what used to bring us pain and distress is, when we experience it as another self in our own self, a source of comfort and hope. How the experience of being poured out into the world makes us large and significant. And we see how the human being grows into those parts of the cosmos. But we also see that human beings may on no account become arrogant, for error, the possibility of error, has by no means disappeared yet. And Johannes Damasius, despite the fact that he has already acquired a great deal of insight into spiritual worlds, can have at that moment the spiritual sensation that the devil incarnate is coming through the door, whereas actually his greatest benefactor, Benedictus, is approaching. Just as this is possible on the spiritual plane, so are innumerable other illusions of the greatest variety. Do not let anyone be intimidated by this. On the contrary, let it be a warning that where the spiritual world is concerned, everyone must, on the one hand, apply discretion, and on the other hand, face the possibility of error bravely and boldly, and on no account allow himself to become despondent if anything appears in any way that shows itself to be an erroneous report from a spiritual world. The human being has to go through all these things in a real way if he really wants to reach what one can call the temple of knowledge, if he wants to ascend to a real understanding of the four great powers of the world, which in a certain respect guide and lead world destiny, and which are represented by the four hierophants of the temple. If we preserve the feeling that the soul has to go through things like this before it is capable of perceiving how the sense world comes forth from the spiritual world, and if we attune ourselves not to want to describe the foundations of the world with ordinary commonplace words, but want in the first place to acquire an insight into the inner value of the words, then we shall sense the significance of the primordial words which are used at the beginning of the Bible to describe the creation. We must feel the necessity to let go of the usual meaning we carry in us of the words, quote, heaven and earth, close quote, create, in quotes, quote, light and darkness, close quotes, and all the other words. We have to let go of the feeling we have in our ordinary life with regard to these words, and have to take steps in the direction of resolving to rise to new levels of feeling, a new evaluation of words, when we attend these lectures, so that we hear not only what the ideas convey, but hear the words telling us what they really mean, and where we will only reach what comes to us out of dark regions of the world with a soul mood properly attuned. I have endeavored to sketch for you in very few words what we showed you yesterday. It was shown under relatively difficult circumstances, and in addition was only possible because of the loyal and devoted work of a number of our anthroposophical friends. Now allow me to express what I wish to say from the depths of my heart, namely that I myself, and no doubt everyone who knows about it, cannot thank all those people enough who have worked with us and shared the risk of putting on this attempt, for an attempt was all it was meant to be. The circumstances under which we dared make the attempt were certainly not the easiest. Those who took part had worked hard for weeks, and this last week called for their total commitment and dedication. And we can consider it a great achievement of our anthroposophical activities that we have artists among us who have already been giving us their loyal artistic support for 2 whole years. Let us be sure to remember our dear friend Dozer, who not only last year and this year took on the difficult task of representing Phosphoros on the stage, but who has also taken upon himself this year a part which is particularly dear to my heart, and which was infinitely important in what we were attempting to show yesterday, the part of Capasius. Perhaps it will only gradually dawn on you why the figure of Capasius is of such particular importance, and the other figure, too, the character of Strater, acted out by our dear Zeiling, who has supported us faithfully for 2 years now, is also of great importance, especially in this context. I must not omit to mention what a great support our dear Herr Zeiling is with his unique voice, when it comes to conveying symbolically the spiritual world in the physical world. All the love and the wonderfully pleasing sound of the spirit voices we owe to his quite extraordinary gift in this direction. It also falls to me to give special thanks to those who put their whole strength into acting the main parts, despite the fact that they had a number of other things to do in the anthroposophical field during this time, and actually the whole year through. We can perhaps say that it is only in the anthroposophical field that anyone can muster the amount of strength that Fräulein von Sievers did to play 2 such big parts, Cleonice and Maria, in 2 successive days. Such a thing is only possible if you put the utmost strength into it that a person can muster. I would like to mention with a particularly grateful heart the lady who took the part of Johannes Thomasius, and it would give me special satisfaction if we were to think of this role of Johannes Thomasius as still being somewhat connected with the first person who acted the part. That it was possible to do it at all under the difficult circumstances is due solely to the intense dedication our dear Fräulein Wahler has for the anthroposophical cause. And if I were to tell you about the difficulty she had to work under due to shortage of time, you would probably be very surprised. All these things taking place among us, arising out of our anthroposophical work, affect us all because, in a spiritual sense, we are an anthroposophical family. So we should feel duty-bound to thank all those who devoted themselves with such dedication to this task, which, always bearing in mind that outsiders are incapable of judging the difficult circumstances, nobody else could possibly have done. May these words enable you to appreciate the heights of dedication to which, over the past days and weeks, the actors have risen, and therefore how justified we are in expressing our deepest thanks just now. I would have to go on for a very long time if I were to thank individually everyone who joined with us in this work. But let us be sure to remember the man who, when it comes to someone in our ranks doing something for the anthroposophical cause, is always on the spot with the appropriate solution, and gives it with all his heart and all his ability. Let us think of our dear friend Aronson, who, both last year and this time, supported us with his beautiful musical skills and made it possible that both in title The Children of Lucifer and in our endeavors of yesterday we could, in the appropriate places, lead over in a most dignified manner to an experience that can only be reached through the world of sound. And let me remind you of our dear artistic friends in Munich. You have had plenty of opportunity over these 2 days to see how we strove to bring everything seen by the eye, EYE, into harmony with the spoken word and the music. You will have seen how, down to the last splash of color and every last form, we strove to integrate it all. If we achieve this to any extent, we owe it to the loving understanding of our artistic friends here, Herr Folkert, Herr Linde, and our dear Herr Haas, and we give them our heartiest thanks for doing all they did to enable everything to run its course in such an admirable way. Such things are only possible, of course, when everyone's work is given freely with heartfelt devotion. This year, too, we should give a special thought to all that was needed in the way of costumes. It is difficult to imagine all that this entails. But to do this properly, it was a job demanding a person's whole time, a person's whole heart and soul. And as, last year too, the person to take on this load, all by herself, was our dear Fräulein von Eckhartstein. She threw herself into the work not only with devotion, but most importantly with the greatest understanding for both the individual details and the overall dignified impression which must never be neglected. However, these are only rough indications of what had to be said out of the feeling of being an anthroposophical family, so that each one of us realizes the driving power behind this teamwork. If the day before yesterday and yesterday you acquired a little satisfaction for your soul and stimulus for your imagination, then let these feelings overflow a little bit in the direction of the people whose names have just been mentioned, and to your familiar friends who appeared on the stage. We would like to think of this milestone of our anthroposophical activity as a flow of anthroposophical ideas, anthroposophical life, into culture. Even if modern humanity is not yet inclined to include in all the rest of external culture what can flow into it from out of the life of the spirit, we would like at least to show in an artistic picture the way the thoughts active in our souls can come alive. Feelings such as these can be sparked off through the anticipation of the fact that human beings will move from the present toward a future when they will be able to feel the streaming down of spiritual life through spiritual and soul veins onto the physical plane. That humankind will go toward a future in which human beings will feel themselves to be mediators between the spiritual and the physical world. These events were undertaken just so that this presentiment could awaken. If we have this kind of presentiment, then we will also find it possible to restore the original glory to words, which have become so worn out that the feelings they engender now block the way to an understanding of their real significance. No one at all will be able to understand the stupendous content of the words with which the Bible opens if he takes them in the way they are used nowadays. We ourselves will have to soar up in thought to those heights where spiritual life pulsates, and to which we tried to follow Johannes Thomasius, if we want to understand physical life on earth. In a certain respect, quite a different language has to be spoken in these spiritual realms. However, we human beings must, at the least, be able to give to the words available to us here quite new values, new nuances of feeling, and have quite a different awareness of them, if they are to signify what the opening passages of the Bible are saying, and if we want to understand the spiritual origin of our physical world. The end of Lecture 11, that is the end of the cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Genesis, Secrets of Creation, which was, I will say, translated by Pauline Verlet.